Following are comments on William Shakespeare's Macbeth, Act II. Is this a dagger which I see before me? Macbeth ruminates on the crime he is about to commit, but then stalks towards Duncan to do the fatal deed. In Act II, Scene 1, sleep-deprived Banquo admits to Macbeth that he, quote-unquote, dreamt last night of the three weird sisters. Act 2, Scene 1, lines 20 through 21. Macbeth asks for Banquo's support, but Banquo remains aloof. He is not certain that his colleague's offer is above board. When Macbeth promises that consenting to his upcoming request, quote-unquote, shall make honor for you, Banquo can only respond, quote-unquote, so I lose none in seeking to augment it. Act 2, Scene 1, lines 25 through 27. Macbeth is now alone with his thoughts, and those thoughts are unnerving ones. Quote unquote, is this a dagger which I see before me, the handle toward my hand? Come, let me clutch thee. I have thee not, and yet I see thee still. Act 2, Scene 1, lines 33 through 35. Macbeth questions the dagger's existence. Might it be, quote unquote, a dagger of the mind, a false creation proceeding from the heat-oppressed brain? Act 2, Scene 1, lines 38 through 39. That's probably the right explanation, but how much does it matter? If the false creation, so-called, comes from Macbeth's own fevered thoughts and desires, it still counsels him to do evil. Whether the dagger is supernatural or not, it is real, at least to Macbeth. As he says to the dagger, quote unquote, thou marshalst me the way that I was going. Act 2, Scene 1, line 42. The bloody knife concentrates his spiritual and bodily forces. Its power may put on the cast of fate, but it seems better to say that the knife manifests the weirdness of the world through which Macbeth now walks. Even as he goes to commit a murder, objects appear to torment him with animistic pranks. Nature, or his mind, begins to play tricks on him. What we see is not Macbeth still tormenting himself with doubts, but reaffirming his prior decision. He is plucking up his audacity and steadiness to the required levels. By the scene's end, Macbeth stalks with, quote-unquote, Tarquin's ravishing strides to the chamber where the king lies. Act 2, Scene 1, line 55. As he might have recalled, Tarquin's dishonorable criminal act of ravishing the Roman matron Lucretia hardly benefited the Tarquin line. The Etruscan prince brought on his own destruction, as will Macbeth after him. So the bell rings by prior arrangement with Lady Macbeth, and at the end of Act 1, Scene 1, Macbeth goes to it. He prays for an easy, quiet kill that accords with the silence and deadness of nature itself. Quote unquote, thou sure and firm set earth, hear not my steps which way they walk, for fear thy very stones prate of my whereabout. Act 2, Scene 1, lines 56 through 58. But we know that when someone is dealing out violent death, such ease cannot be. The liberator assassins Cassius and Brutus in Julius Caesar could tell us that. Methought I heard a voice cry, sleep no more. In the wake of killing Duncan, Macbeth is stricken with conscience, while Lady Macbeth summons strength. In Act 2, Scene 2, Lady Macbeth is anxiety-ridden while enduring the minutes the killing takes. An owl's cry startles her, and she fears that the drugged grooms outside Duncan's quarters have regained consciousness and stopped the murder. Most telling is her admission, quote unquote, had he not resembled my father as he slept, I had done it. Act 2, Scene 2, lines 11 through 13. At a critical point, Lady Macbeth couldn't shake thoughts of filial affection and respect for her own family patriarch. She is not, as thoroughly, unsexed as she desires. Macbeth's initial reaction is one of horror and disbelief. Why didn't anyone hear anything? Act 2, Scene 2, line 14. He is shaken by his inability to say amen in response to the groom's sleepy, potion-soddened God bless us. Act 2, Scene 2, lines 29 through 31 and 34 through 35. He also reports to Lady Macbeth that after stabbing Duncan, words of despair assailed him from within or without. Quote unquote, "Methought I heard a voice cry, sleep no more, Macbeth does murder sleep." Act 2, Scene 2, lines 38 through 39. Strangely enough, Macbeth suffers from Lady Macbeth's disease before his wife does. Today we call obsessive hand washing contamination OCD. He asks, quote unquote, "Will all great Neptune's ocean wash this blood clean from my hand?" Act 2, Scene 2, lines 63 through 64. Hand washing is both practical, since the evidence must be eliminated, and ritually significant as an act of forgetting, if not attaining forgiveness. But in this instance, it gives no relief. So much for Lady Macbeth's claim that, quote unquote, "A little water clears us of this deed." Act 2, Scene 2, line 70. Film enthusiasts may recall that in Alfred Hitchcock's crime thriller Psycho, the character Marianne Crane, a secretary, steals a large sum from her employer and is then forced by a rainstorm to rent a motel room owned by Norman Bates. She takes a shower in what seems like an attempt at spiritual self-cleansing, only to be struck down by the psychotic killer Norman. In literature and film, water is not always the agent of purification we would like it to be. Then comes the famous knocking at the gate, quote unquote, that appalls Macbeth, to use his word. Act 2, Scene 2, line 61. His sensibilities are now heightened and deranged. Macbeth's final words here are, quote unquote, "To know my deed, 'twere best not know myself." Act 2, Scene 2, line 76. Now he must dampen his consciousness and deaden his conscience. But for the moment, Lady Macbeth must grab the daggers from her husband and take care of insinuating the groom's guilt for Duncan's murder. Act 2, Scene 2, lines 55 through 56. At the end of Act 2, Scene 2, then, she plays the role of the man to protect both her temporarily incapacitated husband and herself. "Ring the alarm bell, murder and treason!" A comic porter lets Lennox and Macduff in, and the latter, upon going to wake the king, returns to announce the terrible scene that greeted him. In Act 2, Scene 3, the porter hears knocking at the castle's south side entry and rehearses the role of a porter at Hell's Gates, generating knock-knock jokes. This scene points us toward the true nature of Macbeth's crimes and the reason why he is bound to be disappointed in what they bring. See Act 2, Scene 3, lines 1 through 35 inclusive. The porter, who has obviously enjoyed quite a night of drinking, grumbles, quote unquote, "Knock, knock, knock, who's there in the name of Beelzebub?" Act 2, Scene 3, lines 2 through 4. Before he makes it to the door to allow Macduff and Lennox in, the porter imagines himself as Hell's gatekeeper. And in this context, he makes the first of 5 references to equivocation that, taken together, as the Norton editors explain in their footnote 3 to page 933 of the Norton Shakespeare Tragedies, amount to a topical reference to the Jesuit Catholic priest Henry Garnett. This priest was put on trial over what authorities mistakenly believed was active involvement in the failed 1606 gunpowder plot to blow up King James I and the assembled members of Parliament. Father Garnett, who ended up being convicted and executed, had written a treatise in defense of equivocation for Jesuit priests suffering persecution from Protestant religious or political figures. To equivocate is to engage in verbal deception, to speak in an ambiguous, slippery way so as to deceive others, and so forth. See Wiktionary for a fuller definition. The porter refers to equivocation first with regard to one of the souls he imagines as entering through hell's gates, a man who, he says, quote-unquote, committed treason enough for God's sake, yet could not equivocate his way to heaven. Act 2, Scene 3, line 8 through 9. And secondly, he applies the term to any man who drinks heavily and then can't perform sexually. Strong drink, says the porter, to the understated amusement of Lennox and Macduff, quote-unquote, provokes the desire, but it takes away the performance. Act 2, Scene 3, lines 24 through 25. The witch's prophecies may function similarly with respect to Macbeth. Like an intoxicating brew, those promises arouse Macbeth's latent ambition for advancement. But since Macbeth actually manages to kill the king, what is the performance that this same intoxication supposedly takes away? What are the witches promising that will not be delivered? It can't be simply Macbeth's taking of the crown. The consummation must be security of the outcome. Macbeth wants to enjoy the crown and kingly power in perpetuity, and he wants to be able to pass them along, generational immortality. As he says, quote unquote, to be thus is nothing, but to be safely thus. Act 3, Scene 1, line 48. The witches, however, did not include any clause in their prophecy that indicated whether Macbeth would be king for 3 decades or 3 minutes. They offered no security. Macbeth acts without getting the full story about what the prophesied path entails for his and Lady Macbeth's ultimate well-being. In the end, Macbeth acts only in reaction to bitter necessities of his own making. That hardly amounts to freedom. Unrestrained ambition leads to madness, making its indulgers lose free will and self-respect. Macbeth becomes as impotent as the porter's drunken lecher, even as he hacks his way through his stolen kingship. There is yet another function of the porter scene, recognized by Thomas de Quincey. In On the Knocking at the Gate in Macbeth, this Romantic and Victorian-era author writes that the porter scene captures the moment when a murderous act beyond civilized existence necessarily gives way to everyday life. One cannot live in a perpetual state of monstrous depravity. Macbeth's reality from now on, as the majority of Act 2, Scene 3 after the porter vignette ends, will entail covering up what he and Lady Macbeth have done. He seems to pass the genuine emotion test when Macduff returns from the murder scene, but when Macbeth kills the grooms allegedly out of righteous fury, he fails in a potentially catastrophic way to explain his actions, saying with wild implausibility, quote unquote, I do repent me of my fury that I did kill them. Act 2, Scene 3, lines 103 through 104. This is why modern criminal defense attorneys usually insist that the accused say nothing without counsel present. But seriously, Macbeth is a lucky defendant, as his wife distracts all the assembled lords with a well-timed fainting spell. Finally, the porter's brief appearance widens the frame beyond the selfish circle of Macbeth and his wife. The porter couldn't care less about the castle goings-on. He has his own life to live. Plus, his play-acting as Satan's gatekeeper cuts Macbeth's role as a grand criminal down to size, so that we may for a time see in it a common act of betrayal, fueled by vile ambition and justified by knavish equivocation. We are not to identify with Macbeth or his wife. Malcolm, Duncan's son and heir, is a good enough Machiavellian to see that selfishness is exactly what's driving events here at Inverness, So it's time for him, he says, to head for England. Donalbain will make his way to Ireland. Both brothers will soon fall under suspicion of suborning parricide, even though there's no evidence that they had anything to do with the killing of Duncan. Darkness does the face of earth entomb when living light should kiss it. A solar eclipse portends the political and spiritual darkness descending on Scotland as Macbeth goes to Scone to be crowned king. In the very brief Act 2, Scene 4, a solar eclipse occurs, and Ross, conversing with an elder, asks him, quote unquote, "Is it night's predominance or the day's shame that darkness does the face of earth entomb when living light should kiss it?" Act 2, Scene 4, lines 8 through 10. The elder's answer is that the eclipse is, quote unquote, "unnatural, even like the deed that's done." Act 2, Scene 4, lines 10 through 11. The natural world will signify, it will turn weird, and have its revenge for the unnatural acts, the wicked artifice, enacted by Macbeth and his wife. Macduff informs Ross and the elder that Duncan's sons have been accused in absentia of bribing the grooms to kill him. He also says Macbeth has been appointed king. Ross departs to attend Macbeth's coronation at Scone, but Macduff will go home to his castle at Fife. The new king will struggle with conscience, and for a time he will seem to have killed it, along with fear. But in the end, he will be destroyed. For the time being, however, Macbeth is a huge material success, and all others in Scotland must deal with that and with him as the new king, and Lady Macbeth as his clever queen. In Macduff's declining to attend Macbeth's coronation, we may see the first sign of this new king's coming dissolution. As the second act reaches its conclusion, King Macbeth does not have this worthy thane's trust. Thanks for listening. This audio lecture was recorded on Friday, June 27th, 2025. The foregoing material is copyright 2025 by Alfred J. Drake. For quotations, I have relied on the Norton Shakespeare 3rd edition, 4-volume, genre-based format.